Hello and welcome to the OnFit podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about combating terrorist and criminal financing.
If you look at the global figures that we're aware of at Europol, we know that the size of the criminal economy in Europe, and this is a very conservative estimate, is 115 billion euros in revenue each year.
We talked to Rob Wainwright, Executive Director of Europol. Thank you for joining us today, Rob.
Pleasure, thank you.
Before we examine the impact of terrorist and criminal financing and how we should tackle it, could you please explain the most common methods by which terrorists and criminals transfer and launder their illicit funds transnationally?
Yes, I think on terrorism we're looking at four main methods. Regular bank transfers, most of them international, so using the SWIFT system, using money or value transfer services, through service bureaus, of course, underground banking and hawala, and cash couriers as well. So those have traditionally been the four main methods, but it's the last two that have grown in prominence, underground banking and cash courier of late, because, of course, the anti-money laundering, the combating counter-terrorist financing regulations have tightened the space up. And so we're seeing especially now the increased use of cash couriers, which allows, of course, or rapid remittance of funds to operational cells that are planning terrorist attacks. For criminal financing, what we're looking at here is about 80% of that, I would say, inside the banking and financial system, but with the assistance of professional gatekeepers, often using offshores and tax havens, for example. Then of the remaining amount, around 15% may be using major money laundering techniques, such as cash-intensive businesses, trade-based money laundering, again, cash couriers, hawala, and so on. And then the remaining amount, but growing in scale perhaps, are new threats and new innovations, including virtual currencies. So those are the techniques that we're looking at the moment.
Thank you, Rob. So how has terrorist and criminal financing actually affected the financial sector and the wider economy?
Well, for terrorism financing, actually the cost of planning and mounting most terrorist attacks is actually quite small. We've had, I'm afraid, dozens of terrorist attacks across Europe over the last 3 years alone. We think the average cost is less than 10,000, the cost to plan and carry those out. So in those terms, I guess a limited effect on the financial sector and the economy. Of course, the major impact is directly against the safety and security of our citizens. But for criminal finance, it's a different story. It's been a huge impact on the financial sector and I think in the economy in general as well. Of course, that's because the primary motive of serious criminal activity is to generate profit. And this profit is then invested typically into more crime in a never-ending cycle where crime generates more money then generates more opportunities for more crime. And at a certain point, of course, the financial resources available for the largest criminal syndicates are so large they need to be, in the end, diversified and invested through the legal economy. And that leads then to further problems, further adverse effects on the economy, because those investments tend to corrupt, distort, or unbalance the legal economy. In the end, of course, affecting levels of competition especially. So a direct impact, certainly in the amounts of money that we're seeing going through, but also the way in which it unbalances the economy.
Very interesting. I'd now like to focus on issues surrounding globalization as well as the role of technology. So firstly, what has been the impact of globalization, particularly the reduction of trade barriers and the free movement of capital on terrorist and criminal financial flows?
I think it set the grounds for a new laundering typology. I mentioned it briefly earlier, what we know as trade-based money laundering. And that means the exploitation of the international trade and financial system by criminals to disguise or transport or launder illicit proceeds. And indeed, as global trade levels have increased and as they've become perhaps more open with fewer regulatory burdens, then more opportunities for criminal activities has presented themselves. And I think we're seeing this trade-based money laundering as one of the most popular techniques at the moment for organized crime to integrate the criminal proceeds into the legal financial system, and even for terrorists actually to transfer funds under the radar to desired locations. So I think we're going to see more of this, especially as regimes and countries around the world tighten their anti-money laundering regulations.
And in terms of technology, how have advances in technology, such as the use of private cryptocurrencies, which you mentioned earlier, how has that affected the flow of terrorist and criminal financing across borders?
Yeah, at Europol, we are focusing quite a lot in this area now because we think it's one of the emerging technologies that are being exploited by criminals and terrorists. On terrorism, actually, the number of cases so far are quite low, only a very small number of incidents that we've spotted. And these cases mostly relating to fundraising activities via social media, usually advertised on the dark web, for example, abusing pre-established crowdfunding networks and so on. And these cases However, we've only been able to obtain small amount of cryptocurrencies. But once again, on the criminal side, regarding criminal financing, again, it's a different story. In a considerable increase in the use of cryptocurrencies to perform money laundering activities. And indeed, it's no longer an exclusive tool just for cyber criminals. We're seeing, for example, large-scale drug trafficking organizations, major Colombian drug cartels, for example, and they've now acquired the necessary technical expertise to use cryptocurrencies, indeed, as an instrument for criminal finances. Of course, these cryptocurrencies are attractive to criminality for some reasons similar to how they're attractive to legitimate business, you know, their global availability, ease of access, how reliable perhaps they are in terms of providing a basis of irreversible transactions. But furthermore, of course, they provide certain levels of anonymity. And in the world of ransomware, which has become, for example, a number one cybercrime malware technique for hitting businesses. We'll all remember the WannaCry epidemic in May last year that hit the NHS in England and, in fact, thousands of companies around the world. That's a type of a trend now, ransomware, which, as I said, has become the number one cybercrime threat. And it has done. It's been driven really by the enterprising use of Bitcoin, especially by criminals, because it allows them to demand and receive ransom payments of target companies in an anonymized way. And that's greatly attractive, of course, to the criminals. And also, these cryptocurrencies are outside the normal money laundering regime, and they're not controlled, of course, by a central bank. So for a typical law enforcement process of trying to identify where criminal assets are moving, it's already hard because it's anonymized. And then even if you do, to go through the process of freezing those assets and then confiscating them, you don't have the normal central authorization, central powers in which to do that. And that's what's driving criminal attraction towards cryptocurrency. And the latest development we're seeing is a move away actually gradually from Bitcoin itself into others for even higher levels of security and anonymization. So away from Bitcoin into Monero, Dash, Ethereum, and others as well. Really interesting area, actually, Anton, and one which is not yet dominating, I would say, the world of criminal financing, but it's quickly evolving, and we've got our eyes on it.
Thank you, Robert. That's very interesting. I guess because technology is adapting and developing at an increased pace, it's going to be quite challenging for authorities to keep up with that, whether in terms of enforcement, in terms of on a legal basis as well. Is that something you feel that governments and international organizations are able to rise to the challenge there?
Well, I think it's a challenge. As always, we're in a battle with cyber and other criminals in our law enforcement sector about also modernizing our techniques and ourselves using technology, the latest technology, for us to develop new investigative capabilities, certainly in terms of having a digital forensic analysis capability online. We've had quite a few successes working with the FBI and others around the use of cryptocurrency. So it shows that we are able to adapt as well. But there is a gap in legislation. As I said, these are cryptocurrencies that are outside the normal money laundering regime. That is likely to be changed, I think, in the near future, because it will be brought under those regulations as part of a new EU directive, probably in 2019. So we're getting there, I think, is the message. But for the moment, it's one of the sort of cutting edge challenges that we face in this area.
Of course. Well, I think this leads nicely onto my next question, which is, well, turning now to the ways in which terrorist and criminal financing is being addressed by governments, international organizations and the private sector. Could you please explain the overall challenges and obstacles in tackling such illicit financial flows?
Yes, and that links to the previous question, of course, Anton, in terms of first being the sort of innovative way in which criminals are using technology to transform, and that keeps us on our toes and gives us new dilemmas every day. I think it's symbolized by the fact also there's been a general professionalization of the world of criminal financing. So the emergence in recent years of professional money laundering syndicates whose criminal task it is just to be experts in getting dirty money through the banking system and other means. And they become, you know, highly expert at doing that. These are large syndicates that we've identified across Europe, many of them actually, that are large scale in nature, that are taking millions and millions of, for example, drugs money, and at a cut price, maybe of a fee of 5 or 6%, are getting that through the banking system and are doing it actually quite successfully. Because if you look at the global figures that we're aware of at Europol, we know that the size of the criminal economy in Europe, and this is a very conservative estimate, is 115 billion euros in revenue each year. We also know the amount of criminal assets that we are seizing each year in Europe, and it represents barely 1% of that amount. So we are performing actually collectively in actually a poor way we're not productive in going after criminal assets despite the importance of doing that. Now, that's not because we don't have the necessary regime in place. We've spent years developing an anti-money laundering regime, robust legislation around that being developed all the time, strictly enforced by regulators in different countries around the world. And it's not either because the banks are not doing their part. We calculated that global banks spend $8.2 billion a year implementing these regulatory requirements on anti-money laundering. So it's a huge effort. These are tens of thousands of compliance officers that global banks have to do this. And in the end, our return on investment of all of that is 1%. And that's something that I don't think is good enough. And it's a top priority of mine at the moment. And Europe will try and do something about that, essentially about how efficient the regime is. I think the regime is focused on very standardized brute force way of using algorithm-based transaction monitoring, millions of these in a uniform way. That is not a smart way of doing it. It should be driven by intelligence from the top. Instead of treating everyone as a potential, every transaction as a potential suspicion. Instead, you should use intelligence to identify who the criminal actors are in the system and then proactively interrogate banking systems around those. So there's something here in the way in which the system that has been designed is not running well enough. It's lost its sense of strategic purpose in the end because it's become compliance driven instead of really thinking about how can we best find these criminal profits. And it's a really interesting but challenging area.
That is really interesting and illuminating, Rob. Now, I'd like to obviously discuss that element a bit further on how the processes can be improved in this area. But I'd just briefly like to talk about private and public sector collaboration, which is clearly crucial in combating terrorist and criminal financial flows. So I'd like for you to go into a bit more detail about how the private and public sector actually do collaborate in this area and how successful they've been so far.
Well, those global figures about how successful the whole system has been is pretty low, so we're clearly not doing well enough. I think, however, there are structures in place, and there are some very good examples, some sources of bright light here that we can do more of in the future. On terrorism financing especially, I think we're doing a pretty good job. We have a good set of legislative measures in place, a good set of public-private partnerships that allow us to track terrorist financing very well. At Europe, we helped to run the Terrorist Financing Tracking Program, which is an international agreement between the European Union and the United States that has been a hugely important part of the ability of national authorities throughout Europe and the United States to track terrorist financing and has played a very important part, for example, in our ability to respond to the recent terrorist attacks in Europe. So there are mechanisms like that that have been laid down on terrorist financing that are working rather well. On criminal financing, also, you know, good public-private partnerships, a relatively new initiative in the United Kingdom, Joint Money Laundering Intelligence Task Force, bringing a number of the biggest banks together with their law enforcement counterparts in the UK to see if we can use intelligence from policing better to drive a different kind of response in the way that I was talking about under the previous question. What we're trying to do at Europol is to take that national best example with one or two others that are springing up now, take it to the transnational level, because one of the other real challenges we face here is that we're using a system that is essentially designed at the national level. All of the structures of reporting between banks and suspicious reporting between banks and law enforcement are governed within national frameworks largely. And yet the problem of illicit flows of money are clearly international in nature. So Europol is trying to, therefore, deliver a sort of transnational response. And we ourselves are running this major initiative now with the Institute of International Finance. And we've brought around 12 to 15 global banks together at boardroom level. And I'm helping to co-chair that process to really understand how we can improve this. And I think we might be on the edge of doing something very important and driving up, therefore, our success rate in going after criminal money.
Thank you, Rob. Now, speaking of dealing with these issues on a transnational level, I think it's important to bring up the UK's withdrawal from the European Union and the impact that this may have. So how will Brexit affect the ability to tackle illicit financial flows between the UK and the rest of the continent?
I mean, it's a subset of a wider question. How will it affect the ability to counter terrorism and counter organized crime in general, of course, because tackling illicit financial flows is an element of that. And on that question, I think the obvious first answer is it depends on how the negotiations go. And I can't predict that. What I do know, however, is that getting the right security deal between the UK and the EU is a top priority. I know that from speaking with the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary in the UK and their equivalents in the EU. So I know that their commitment is there. there's a general recognition, I think, that what we're looking at in Europe, particularly in light of this terrible terrorist threat that we're living through at the moment, is that these are serious issues. We have serious security challenges in Europe, cybercrime, terrorism, large-scale organized crime, and the nature of those threats are transnational. And that, of course, means that we have to have the most cohesive, most integrated cross-border cooperation between the countries in Europe as possible. And indeed, that's been exactly the focus of Europol's work and indeed what everything that we've been doing as a European Union in the last 10 years to respond to essentially the transnational nature of what security has become. Now, we can't afford, therefore, a major country in that enterprise to be dislocated from that integrated effort. Clearly not. It will harm the UK, it will harm the rest of Europe as well. And as I said, I think there's an understanding at the political level about the urgency and the importance of this, and I expect a good deal would be found. But there are complexities to be overcome, and I think there's quite a bit of work to be done yet before we can get to the end of this. So I think providing we get the right kind of deal, there's no reason to think that the UK will not still be quite an important actor, quite a reliable actor in the European security sector. The status of its involvement will change, certainly in legal and political terms, but I hope that the UK will continue to be a major player here.
That's great, Rob. Now, to conclude and looking ahead, having addressed how terrorist and criminal financing is currently being dealt with, what would you say are the key things that governments and international organizations can do to most effectively tackle this form of illicit finance in the future? What are the main ways the process could be improved?
Well, I think the Financial Action Task Force, for example, does a good job in setting recommendations and standards around the world. So I think, you know, part of this is around ensuring each government has full compliance around those recommendations and legislative measures. And I think compliance, if you look at the recent round of evaluations that the FATA laid out, it shows there's generally good compliance, at least around Europe. So we need to make sure there's full compliance with the standards that the international community we've set. Secondly, nonetheless, we need to recognize the scale of the problem, understand that, you know, there still seems to be large-scale corruption in society and indeed large-scale attempted corruption of the international financial system, and the revelations of the Panama and Paradise Papers perhaps give you sort of an insight into that as well. So, you know, a commitment, I would say, from all governments, of course, to go after corruption and maybe where the loopholes are around that in a more aggressive way. But the third thing is just to highlight the point I made earlier. We also have to use the system that we've built in a smarter way, because a 1% success rate is not good enough. Even that 1% success rate comes at a huge cost to banks themselves and, of course, to legislators and regulators as well. So we have a commitment as a community. We have a responsibility to work in a smarter way, to maybe update, modernize the regime that we have so that we can go after this. But it will require, you know, an appetite from central governments, for example, and the regulators that are formed by them to understand that just being compliant is not good enough. You know, you have to be compliant for a reason. That's not the end in itself. Being compliant means, hopefully, that means that's good enough for stopping criminal money going through the system. So it's the form of compliance that really matters, not just the tick box methodology we have at the moment of saying, fine, we have this methodology of A to Z. You tick all those boxes, we stamp you as compliant, fine. Meanwhile, 99% of criminal assets are not being confiscated, and that's not good enough.
Thank you very much, Rob, for a very illuminating discussion. It was great to hear your thoughts on the methods by which terrorists and criminals transfer and launder their funds, the impact of such financing on the financial sector and wider economy, issues surrounding globalization and technology, as well as how terrorist and criminal financing is being tackled. Next week's podcast examines the future global order and features Danny Kwa, Professor of Economics at Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. This will be available on the OnFIF channel on Tuesday, so you can download it once it has been broadcast, or subscribe to our channel. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review.